is to Americans that when other countries deny their own aggressive intent or question American claims, their denial and questioning are perceived as disingenuous and a strategic bargaining stance. Of course, from the perspective of America's rivals, the story is a mirror image, and such American claims are highly suspect. In summary, humans evolved to be highly cooperative, but the underlying evolutionary pressure was a fight for survival. Our cooperative nature evolved to make us fiercer competitors, so it should come as no surprise that our cooperative nature doesn't extend automatically to members of other groups. Indeed, other groups were often a serious threat to our ancestors' survival, so cooperation across group boundaries relies on a very tenuous form of trust. Due to the fact that fairness is relative, this trust between groups is threatened whenever we perceive another group as benefiting more from an agreement than we do, even if that agreement is clearly more beneficial than no agreement at all. Lastly, because we hypocritically perceive the motives of our own group positively, but the same motives of other groups as suspect, we are unwilling to extend the benefit of the doubt to other groups, but are dubious when other groups fail to extend the benefit of the doubt to us. All these psychological factors pose important obstacles to our ability and willingness to achieve lasting peace and security with members of other ethnic groups, religions, and nations. But our evolved psychology is also highly sensitive to context, as it is the flexibility of human cognition and behavior that has made us such an evolutionary success story. Thus, the barriers to peace imposed by these deeply ingrained psychological tendencies can be overcome, not through reassurance or denial, but through structures, processes, and agreements that align the interests of previously hostile groups, or through agreements and verification strategies that bypass these concerns. When people see their interests aligned with other groups, or when they believe that it is impossible to cheat on an agreement, they are no longer hypervigilant for signs of cheating, nor are they tempted to cheat themselves. It can be difficult to align the interests of different groups, particularly when the groups have a long history of conflict, but numerous societal forces can achieve this goal over time. Increasing democracy, greater awareness and understanding of other cultures through increased contact, and numerous other societal changes drive groups toward cooperation and away from conflict. The increasing integration of the international community through travel, trade, and tourism, as well as increasing integration over the internet, has the potential to create in many people an overarching group identity as fellow humans, rather than as members of certain tribes, ethnicities, countries, or religions. When such alignment of interests and redrawing of group boundaries are not possible, scientific advances in the capacity to detect cheaters, combined with agreements that are based on a realistic understanding of our evolved psychology, create the circumstances that make it possible to trust by verifying. Part 3. Using knowledge of the past to build a better future. Chapter 9. Why evolution gave us happiness. One Friday morning in 2007, commuters on the Washington, D.C. Metro got a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. As a study in human psychology, the Washington Post arranged for Joshua Bell, one of the world's great violinists, to busk in a downtown metro station. For nearly 45 minutes, Bell played classical music on his Stradivarius, during which time more than 1,000 commuters entered the doorway directly in front of him. The Post had made elaborate plans in case the crowd got out of hand, but its preparations proved unnecessary. Only 7 people stopped to listen to Bell for more than a minute. What these commuters didn't know was that thousands of people pay a small fortune to hear Bell play in symphonies all over the world, at which point they have to dress up in their finest, struggle to find parking, and sit at a great distance from the master. Much has been made of this demonstration and its outcome. How could the same man be so sought after, yet so readily ignored? As the Washington Post explained, Bell was art without a frame. In the context of a metro station, people didn't know what to make of his music and were unable to appreciate it. No doubt there is some truth to this interpretation, as the price of a painting goes through the roof when we discover it's a Picasso and drops through the floor when we discover it's not, even though the painting itself hasn't changed an iota. But there is more to this story than context. Intentionally or not, when it set up this event, the Post tapped into a deeply ingrained feature of the human psyche. By way of explanation, consider a classic psychology experiment from the early 1970s. John Darley and Dan Batson of Princeton University were pondering the story of the Good Samaritan and wondering why so many people fail to help the unfortunate soul who has been beaten and robbed. Jesus tells this parable to highlight that everyone is our neighbor, and even the lowliest member of society can play an important role. Samaritans were a disliked group at the time. Darley and Batson took away a different lesson, wondering if perhaps the Samaritan was the only one to help because there was nowhere else he had to be. The Levite and the priest were more important than the Samaritan, and the fact that they walked by the man in need raised the possibility that they had other demands on their time. So Darley and Batson set out to test whether being in a rush might predict who helps and who doesn't. The two researchers are both incredibly nice people, but to drive home their point, they designed a study with a particularly sadistic streak. In their experiment, Darley and Batson asked seminary students to give a brief talk about what can be learned from the parable of the Good Samaritan. The students were told one of three things. One, they had plenty of time to go to the office where their speech would be recorded. Two, they had just enough time to get there. Or three, they would need to hurry because they were behind schedule. The students then headed off to give their talk, and on their way, they encountered a person in need of help. Darley and Batson had paid an actor to lie on the ground moaning, positioned so the seminary students almost needed to step over him on their way to explain how important it is to help people in need. The critical question was how many of them would heed the advice they were about to give. Consistent with Darley and Batson's predictions, the students were much less likely to help if they were behind schedule than if they had plenty of time. But perhaps the most remarkable finding of all is that across the three conditions, only 53% of the seminary students stopped even to ask the man if he was all right. The extraordinary failure of these students to help the needy individual gives us a clue about why commuters on the Washington Metro failed to stop when they walked past Joshua Bell. In both cases, people were focused on the future. I suspect that many of the seminary students didn't really notice the person in need of help. They clearly saw him, as some of them stepped right over him, but they were so busy thinking about how they could persuade other people to be helpful that they probably paid him almost no attention. In the same manner, the commuters in the Washington Metro probably barely heard Joshua Bell through the buzz of their own thoughts, as they focused on how to deal with their difficult boss or their coworker who keeps stealing their lunch from the office fridge. As I discuss in Chapter 6, this capacity to travel in time mentally and make complex plans for the future has given us an enormous selective advantage. Unfortunately, that advantage comes at a cost, given that the time we spend living in the future distracts us from the present. As a consequence, people often fail to appreciate the pleasures or demands of the moment because they pay so little attention to the here and now. In my own case, I can't tell you how many times I've barely tasted a delicious snack because my mind was on an upcoming lecture, our next vacation, or how I was going to explain yet another speeding ticket to my wife. Our proclivity to live in the future and ignore the present is not an easy problem to solve. Although the varied approaches to mindfulness around the globe reflect the fact that many people try. Most meditation practices teach people to live in the moment. This is a laudable goal, but it's incredibly difficult to achieve because it's at odds with an evolved skill that has served us so well over the last million plus years. We have a great deal of difficulty shutting down thoughts of the future, unless the demands or pleasures of the moment are so substantial that they drag us back to the here and now. My dogs, in contrast, show no signs of this inner struggle. They live in the moment because they are incapable of casting their minds forward. Every treat I give them is devoured with gusto, regardless of whether it means we just finished dinner or are off to the vet. Of course, planning for tomorrow isn't their strong suit, and thus their lives are under my control rather than the other way around. As in so many other ways, evolution gives with one hand but takes with the other. And this, in turn, brings us to what may be the most important question of all. Why aren't we always happy? I've often wondered what it would be like to win the lottery and suddenly have more money than I could ever reasonably spend. I won't win because I don't play, but of course most people's lottery dreams never come true. This is not such a bad thing. As hard as it is to believe, lottery winners are usually no happier than they were before they won, and a fair few of them are a lot less happy. Not the day after they win, that's a pretty good day. But by a year or two later, most people have adapted to their new normal, and their happiness has returned to where it was before they drew the winning ticket. They may be driving a nicer car, but their mind is focused on the fact that they're still sitting in traffic. Worse yet, some of them are focused on all the problems that their windfall has brought them, as friends and family come out of the woodwork expecting them to share their good fortune. As Sandra Hayes put it after winning the $224 million Missouri lottery in 2006, "I had to endure the greed and the need that people have. These are people who you've loved, and they're turning into vampires trying to suck the life out of me." The sad truth is that all of us have dreams, but even when our dreams come true, we rarely end up happier than we were before. New successes bring new challenges. The German folk saying, "Vor Freude ist die schönste Freude," anticipated joy is the greatest joy, is much more accurate than Disney's Happily Ever After. Why did evolution play this dirty trick on us, giving us dreams of achievements that will provide lifelong happiness, but then failing to deliver the emotional goods when we achieve our goals? Some have blamed our modern world and the many discrepancies between our current lives and how we used to live, more on this later. But there is more to it than that. The advent of agriculture has led to major changes, many of which are disruptive for happiness. But our hunter-gatherer ancestors were also incapable of achieving lasting happiness. The more important answer to this question lies in the fact that evolution doesn't care if we're happy, so long as we're reproductively successful. Happiness is a tool that evolution uses to incentivize us to do what is in our genes' best interest. If we were capable of experiencing lasting happiness, evolution would lose one of its best tools. By way of example, consider two hypothetical ancestors, Thag and Crag. Both of them are sitting in a cave during the Pleistocene, eating lizard tails and dreaming of killing a mastodon. It's a pretty big ask to slog across the freezing glacier only to face such a dangerous animal, but in our hypothetical scenario, both of them live the dream and single-handedly kill the beast. Actually, that's too unlikely. Let's put them in charge of the hunt. As expected, both are incredibly happy and are the toast of their respective clans. Imagine what would happen if Thag stayed incredibly happy forever, while Crag dropped back to baseline within a week or so. Thag no longer feels the need to go out and kill anything, as he is content to relax in the cave and relive the exploits of his hunt. Crag, on the other hand, is motivationally hungry again, with a need to achieve. His continued ambition will get him off his duff and back out on the ice. This will result in further successes, which will attract a mate and the respect of his clan, and maybe his appreciative friends will see to it that he gets to sleep a little closer to the fire. But our happy hippie, Thag, will soon be of little interest to the group by virtue of his lack of productivity. No one will want to hear his story about the mastodon anymore, and people will start asking the age-old question, "What have you done for me lately?" He won't particularly care. He is, after all, permanently happy. But he'll suffer the social and reproductive consequences regardless, and there will be fewer baby Thags in the next generation. As is evident in this epic tale of Thag and Crag, Our inability to achieve lasting happiness pushed our ancestors to reach for further goals, which in turn meant that they left more offspring in the next generation. We see a similar pattern today when we examine the motivational effects of happiness over time. Really happy people are rarely high achievers because they simply don't need to be. As Ted Turner put it, you'll hardly ever find a super achiever anywhere who isn't motivated at least partially by a sense of insecurity. The data agree with Ted. Shigehiro Oishi of the University of Virginia and his colleagues documented the relationship between prior happiness and future earnings. They found that people who were unhappy in the mid-1980s go on to earn less money in the early 2000s than their happier compatriots. No surprise here, happy people are more energetic and compelling than sad people, and being energetic and compelling helps them earn more money. More important for the current point, the moderately happy folks went on to earn the most money 15 years later, while the earnings of the very happy folks look a lot like those of the unhappy ones. Some joy is clearly good for success in life, but too much happiness is a financial disaster. This is why evolution designed us to be reasonably happy, with occasional moments of giddiness that soon fade as we return to our individual baseline level of happiness. Numerous self-help professionals would have us believe that attaining maximal or permanent happiness should be our goal, but an evolutionary perspective clarifies that such a goal is neither achievable nor desirable. Happiness evolved for a reason. It gets us out there killing mastodons. But happiness is more than just a motivator. It also plays a critical role in the connection between mind and body. So before turning to the question of exactly what makes us happy, let's spend a little time figuring out why happiness is important, even for the unrepentant curmudgeons among us. Happiness and health. Late one evening about a decade ago, I received an unexpected call on my cell phone. The caller was from overseas, and the connection was poor, so I missed his name, but caught something about his being in an anthropology department at what sounded like Rutgers University. I didn't ask him to repeat himself, as I figured that most people don't call at that hour and it would soon become clear who he was and what he wanted. After a bit of idle chit-chat, the caller told me that he had been invited to take a sabbatical in Berlin the following year, and he wanted me to join him. I have nothing against sabbaticals or Berlin. In fact, I'm a big fan of both. But I have my own commitments, so I was politely excusing myself from this unusual request, when it dawned on me that I was talking to Robert Trivers. I'd had the good fortune of meeting him at a small conference about 5 years prior to that phone call, and although I'd spoken with him only a few times in the intervening years, he has a distinct, gravelly voice that I eventually recognized over the poor telephone line. If it was Trivers who was inviting me on sabbatical, then that changed everything. So I told him to hold on for a moment while I covered the mouthpiece and asked my wife how she felt about a sabbatical in Berlin. She thought that sounded like fun, so I told him to count me in. We arrived at the wonderful Wissenschaftskolleg in Berlin in October 2008. The plan was for me to spend the next 6 months working with Trivers to help develop his theory of self-deception, discussed in Chapter 5. Trivers is legendary, not just for his brilliance, but also for his mercurial temperament. You don't need to take my word for it, just get a copy of his autobiography, Wild Life, and at that point, I didn't know him well. So I was a little concerned about how our collaboration would proceed. It turned out that we got along famously, but that first week, we definitely got off to a rocky start. In one of our first meetings, Trivers suggested that our immune system can serve as a bank. I had no idea what he meant by that, but I nodded thoughtfully. And that we evolved to orient ourselves toward positive thoughts as we aged in an effort to enhance our immune functioning. I wasn't sure what he meant by that either. I was aware that older adults tend to remember positive things in life better than negative things, whereas younger adults remember the positive and negative equally well. The predominant theory in psychology to explain this effect is that older adults are aware that they have a limited time left on this planet, so they prioritize positive emotional experiences, much as students do when they are about to graduate and leave their friends behind. I had always found this theory convincing, and felt that with his alternative theory, Trivers was barking up the wrong tree. I was also aware that evolution has a much stronger impact on people before they reproduce than after, so an evolutionary basis for the increase in positivity with age seemed unlikely to me. After a fair bit of arguing and a fair bit of explaining, Bob eventually convinced me that this was an idea worth testing. As I discuss in the prologue, in our pre-medical past, grandparents played an important role in the survival of their grandchildren. More on this later. Which suggests that their longevity is important to their grandchildren. Indeed, humans show several adaptations that enhance functioning late in life, such as changes in our genetic makeup that protect us against Alzheimer's and other forms of neurological decline that impact only older adults. These findings raise the possibility that evolution might also shape older adults' motivational system to keep them alive as long as possible. But what did Trivers mean with his talk of the immune system as a bank? Why would older adults capitalize on it? And what does any of this have to do with the importance of happiness and its relationship to health? Let me answer these questions one at a time. When we consider the costs of development and maintenance, our brain is our most expensive organ. It demands 20% of our metabolic energy at all times, whether we are solving math problems or watching reruns. Due to its constant energy requirement, there is no way to borrow energy from the brain when our need for energy exceeds the available supply. In contrast, our muscles use way more energy when they are active than when they are at rest. So, in principle, we could borrow energy from our muscles by sitting down and relaxing. The problem with this strategy is that most of the energy-demanding emergencies our ancestors faced required a muscular response. There was no way to borrow energy from our muscles during an emergency because sitting down when a mastodon showed up was not an effective option. This brings us to our immune system, which also hums along at great metabolic cost, but largely in the service of future needs rather than current ones. At any one moment, we have an enormous number of immune cells coursing through our body, so we can afford a momentary break from production if the demands on our metabolic energy supply become pressing. When our body is in need of more energy than it has, one of the first things it sacrifices is immune function. When did our ancestors face pressing energy demands? Running from hungry saber-toothed tigers and thwacking enemies with a club would be prime examples. When you can feel a tiger's hot breath on your neck as you cover the last few yards to the nearest tree, you don't really need to waste energy making more immune cells to fight off tomorrow's cold. What you do need is to shift all available resources to your legs with the hope that you'll live to see another cough or sneeze. Because fighting and running for our lives are not happy times, evolution took advantage of this fact to link our bodily systems to our psychological states. As a result, our immune system evolved to hum along at peak capacity when we're happy, but to slow down dramatically when we're not. This is why long-term unhappiness can literally kill you through its immune-suppressing effects, and why loneliness in late adulthood is deadlier than smoking. Indeed, once you're over 65, you're better off smoking, drinking, or overeating with your friends than you are sitting at home alone. With this background in mind, Trivers hypothesized that older adults evolved a strategy of turning this relationship on its head, becoming more focused on the positive things in life in an effort to enhance their immune functioning. Such a strategy would be more sensible for older than younger adults for two reasons. First, older adults have a weaker immune system than younger adults and face greater threats from tumors and pathogens. Second, older adults know much more about the world than younger adults do, so they don't need to pay as much attention to what's going on around them. For example, when older adults interact with a surly bank employee or a harried flight attendant, they have a library of related experiences to draw upon and can respond to the situation effectively without giving it much thought. As a result, they can afford to gloss over some of the unpleasant things in life. When I returned from Berlin to my lab at the University of Queensland, I raised this hypothesis with my collaborator, Julie Henry, and with Trivers on board, we asked my student, Elise Kalokarinos, if she would like to take the lead in testing the idea for her PhD. Elise thought it sounded like fun, so she set about finding a way to test it. Over the course of the next year, she brought young and old adults into the laboratory and showed them photographs of nice things, such as baskets of puppies, and photographs of nasty things, such as plane crashes, and then tested their memory for the pictures. Sure enough, our participants who were over 65 tended to remember the puppies better than the plane crashes, which suggests that they were paying more attention to the positive, while our younger participants remembered both equally well. Elise then asked our older participants to return to the lab 1 and 2 years later so we could draw blood to assess their immune functioning. The immune system is vast, but in this initial study, we decided to focus on a class of white blood cells known as CD4s. These cells facilitate immune functioning by triggering other white blood cells, known as B cells, to produce antibodies. Elise found that better memory for positive but not negative pictures was associated with higher CD4 counts and lower CD4 activation. Activated CD4s are busy fighting infection. Prior to activation, they are simply available if needed, 1 and 2 years later. Higher CD4 counts usually indicate a greater preparedness to fight off illness. In contrast, higher activation of CD4s indicates that the person is busy fighting infection and thus is in poor health. In other words, the more positive their memories were today, the healthier they were next year and the year after. This relationship between positivity and memory and CD4s raises the possibility that by focusing on the positive aspects of life, we enhance our own immune functioning. These findings are not a good fit with the theory that positivity with age is caused by older adults' awareness of their limited time on this planet, but they are consistent with other research showing that happiness plays an important role in health and longevity. For example, when researchers intentionally expose people to cold viruses, they find that people who are happy and have good social support are less likely to catch a cold than unhappy people and those with poor social support. Happy and well-supported people also heal more quickly when intentionally wounded in the name of science. This effect holds for our primate cousins as well. Wild monkeys in the mountains of Morocco who have stronger friendship ties show a decreased physiological stress response, i.e. reduced steroid hormones in their feces, to cold weather and aggression from other monkeys. Notice that the key issues for monkeys and for us are friendship and social support. Satisfying relationships play an important role in proper immune functioning. My favorite experiment on this effect is by Jan Kaikoldt-Glaser at Ohio State University and her colleagues. In their study, they brought couples into the lab on 2 different occasions to create blisters on the inside of their forearms by attaching small vacuum suction devices. After they had suctioned up 8 blisters on the participants' arms, they then snipped the skin off the top of the blisters and put little plastic tubs over them. I know this sounds horrific, but apparently it's not as bad as it seems. These tubs were now artificial blister chambers that the researchers could use to collect blister goo to examine cellular immune responses throughout the experiment. On the first visit to the lab, the researchers asked the couples to discuss their relationship history. And on the second visit, they asked them to discuss areas of ongoing conflict, such as money or in-laws. The researchers made themselves scarce while these conversations took place, but recorded them for later analysis. Despite the semi-public nature of the setting, couples were quite willing to speak their minds. For example, "You're only being nice, so I'll have sex with you tonight." "You were being mean on purpose." This experiment yielded several interesting findings. First, the blisters took 1 more day to heal after the conflict discussions than after the more positive initial conversations. Second, the blisters took an extra 2 days to heal among couples who were hostile to each other during their conflict discussions compared to the couples who were not. Third, the cellular immune activity inside the blisters mirrored what was going on with the healing. There were large increases in inflammation following hostile conflict discussions, but almost no increase in inflammation following non-hostile conflict discussions. These inflammatory responses are implicated in cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and other illnesses, which is precisely why happy marriages help us live longer, and why unhappy marriages and loneliness shorten our lives. These findings also clarify why even people who enjoy living alone need regular human contact, a group that matters to them, and meaningful friendships. People differ in how many friends they need and how often they need to see them, but everyone requires social connections to maintain health and happiness. So, what is the purpose of happiness? As you can see, there is no single answer to this question. Happiness motivates us to do things that help us survive and reproduce, but happiness is not an end in and of itself. Evolution often sacrifices our happiness in the service of other goals. Those who cannot feel pain and despair are severely constrained in their ability to learn to avoid bad people, situations, and ideas. Indeed, negative emotions are just as important as positive ones, perhaps even more so, as the costs of plans gone awry can far outweigh the benefits of success. We saw in Chapter 5 that happiness is readily apparent to others and its signaling value is not lost on people who are trying to size you up as a potential partner, ally, or enemy. In this sense, happiness is also a critically important social emotion. Happiness serves as a signal to our own bodies as well, by communicating that now would be a good time to expend energy on repair and illness prevention. Chapter 10. Finding Happiness in Evolutionary Imperatives. Now that we've discussed the purpose of happiness, we can turn to the question of exactly what makes us happy. Because evolution shaped our motivational system, consideration of our evolutionary imperatives should give us some traction on how to lead a good life. Given our particular imperatives, you may think an evolutionary guide to happiness would be a pretty short pamphlet, or perhaps even just the simple equation, food plus sex equals happiness. No doubt there is some truth to this equation, but the story is also much more complex. Happiness may be a matter of meeting our evolutionary imperatives, but these imperatives are often at cross purposes with one another. And a good deal of wisdom and self-knowledge is required to navigate successfully among them. This challenge can be seen most readily in our two paramount goals of reproduction and survival. Despite the fact that we must achieve both to pass our genes on to the next generation, reproduction is the currency of evolution, and survival is only important to the degree that it serves that goal. The challenges inherent in managing our evolutionary urges are magnified by numerous other complexities, some ancient and some modern. On the ancient side, although our imperatives are universal, our strategies for achieving them are not. For many species, there's only one way to get ahead in life. If you are a male dung beetle, you must be able to roll a ball of feces that is many times your body weight. If you are a male moose, you must be able to knock other moose on their bums when you butt heads. But for humans, the number of strategies available to us is limited only by our imagination. Do I curl, straighten, or cut my hair? Do I whiten my teeth or spend my money on braces? Do I pose for my Tinder photo next to my stamp collection or my boxing trophy? To understand how to achieve happiness, we need to understand how our personalities, proclivities, and abilities each can make us a success. Not every road leads to happiness, but different roads suit different people. On the modern side, our highly technological world continues to develop new tricks to short-circuit our pursuit of happiness via what Robert Trivers calls phenotypic indulgences. Phenotypic indulgences, while pleasing, are really just surrogates for our evolved preferences. Alcohol and drugs, television, and even potato chips are all phenotypic indulgences. They mimic ancient pleasures without delivering the outcomes that made those ancient activities adaptive and hence pleasurable. Think of the difference between watching friends and having friends. If the notion that humans have evolutionary imperatives strikes you as overly deterministic, it is important to remember that we also evolved to be the most cognitively flexible species on the planet. As I discuss in Chapter 2, humans need to learn an extraordinary amount of information to survive and thrive, And more than any other animal, we chart our own life course. That doesn't mean we can find happiness in everything we do. Most of us cannot. But it does mean we get to decide the importance of happiness in our life, as well as the most fruitful way to pursue it. Understanding human nature through the pressures exerted by our evolutionary past can guide us in this pursuit and also help us understand happiness itself. An evolutionary guide to happiness. Evolution depends on reproduction, first and foremost. But that fact has led to two common misconceptions. The first misconception is the belief that we must have children of our own if we are to pass on our genes. In fact, we can also be an evolutionary success if we enhance the reproductive success of our relatives. Evolutionary pressures can lead people to be a good uncle or auntie in the same manner as a good parent, and the outcome is much the same. Helping nieces and nephews ensures that copies of the good uncle's or auntie's genes will have a better chance of making it into the next generation. The second misconception is the widespread belief that evolution gave us a desire to reproduce. Just because evolution relies on reproduction doesn't mean that humans evolved a desire to have children. Until very recently in our evolutionary history, we had no idea that sexual relations created children. So evolution would have achieved nothing by giving us a desire for children. Rather, evolution gave us a strong desire to have sex. And then, because we are a species that requires parental care, tossed in a tendency to feel fond of any children we produced. By evolving sexual desire plus nurturance, we arrived at the same outcome as we would have if we'd evolved to want children and knew how to produce them. This combination of wanting sex and feeling nurturant toward resulting offspring works for us and every other mammal, or at least every other female mammal. Biparental care is pretty rare among our furry cousins. You might argue that a desire for sex in the absence of a desire for children is inefficient, and indeed it is. Humans and other primates have all sorts of wasteful sex that cannot possibly lead to reproduction. I suspect that the evolution of hands was followed 45 minutes later by the invention of masturbation, which would have been impossible with hooves and too risky with claws. Nevertheless, so long as we engage in enough of the reproductive sort of sexual activity, the wasted energy cost of non-reproductive sex is likely to be low. Due to the central role of sex in reproduction, frequent sexual activity, particularly if you can arrange it with someone you like, is a key to the good life. But frequent sexual activity alone is insufficient to successfully reproduce, and hence insufficient for a happy life. The long period of dependency in human children dictates that parenthood is also critically important for reproduction. In fact, children are so difficult to raise that parents are barely sufficient, and thus evolution invented the grandparent. As I discuss in the prologue, Lachtenpera and her colleagues found that our ancestors were more likely to survive childhood and mothers were more likely to have children in rapid succession if they had the help of a grandmother. How did evolution create grandmothers? By preventing women from producing more children of their own while they still had plenty of life in them, evolution gave them the opportunity to focus on their grandchildren rather than their children. Remember, women had no control over their fertility at that time. This is why human females evolved menopause. When Susan Alberts of Duke University and her colleagues compared humans with other primates, they found that we are unique among our primate cousins in the female tendency to outlive fertility. The other apes and monkeys remain fertile until they die. For example, the latest that chimp females tend to give birth is around age 40, and the longest they tend to live is also around age 40. The human example is from Kung hunter-gatherers who have little or no access to modern medical care, and thus give us a better sense of how our ancestors lived than we could get from humans living in industrialized countries. The latest age at which Kung women tend to give birth is in their early 40s, but the longest they tend to live is into their mid-70s. If there were no need for grandparenting, it would be an unusual evolutionary arrangement for women to outlive their fertility by such a wide margin. Remember, evolution doesn't care about survival for its own sake. Raising and teaching our children and grandchildren are thus an important source of life satisfaction. That doesn't mean that we evolved to enjoy every moment we spend with them. When my kids were little, Monday morning and off to school you go couldn't come soon enough. But it does mean that we get enormous satisfaction from seeing our children succeed in life. Just a few minutes at your child's high school graduation or wedding provide ample demonstration of that fact. This next point might sound sexist, but as I discuss in Chapter 4, women have a much greater obligatory biological investment than men in creating and raising children. As a consequence, it is likely that raising children and grandchildren plays a larger role in female than in male life satisfaction. Be that as it may, it is in both men's and women's interest to facilitate the survival of their offspring and those of their close family. So, providing for the next generation of kin is likely to be an important source of happiness for everyone. This is not to say that the day-to-day tasks of raising children are fun, as they often aren't. But the knowledge that you've done the right thing for your children is a great source of life satisfaction. So far, this recipe for happiness, have sex and do a good job raising your children, probably seems inherently obvious to the most casual observer. But reproduction is more complicated than that, and so are its implications for life satisfaction. One of the most complicated aspects of human reproduction is finding the right partner in the first place. Choosing a long-term partner requires an ability to predict your preferences far into the future, and you need only consider your prior clothes or hairstyle to realize how difficult that task is. Indeed, I struggle at the fruit market each week, trying to predict which bunch of bananas will ripen before they turn brown, a decidedly easier task than predicting if Courtney or Kim will be more likely to interest me for the next 40 to 50 years. The difficulty of this prediction problem is exacerbated in a species like ours, which forms enduring pair bonds, as partnership is a mutual decision. If we were laughing tree frogs, a real Australian frog, by the way, then every female could mate with the most desirable male, as his role in the process involves nothing more than fertilizing the eggs. But because we work together to raise our young, it is not possible for every woman to mate with the most desirable man, or vice versa. Rather, the resultant compromises necessitated by limited availability and mutual choice demand that we trade some preferred aspects for others. And of course, different people are likely to make different trade-offs when choosing a partner. You might care more about kindness, I might care more about shared values, and someone else might be particularly concerned with brains, beauty, or finances. The best way to solve the problem of mutuality is to be as desirable as possible, as that increases the chances that the one you love will love you back. For this reason, evolution motivates us to do things that improve our chances of attracting and keeping the person with whom we most want to have sex and children. In other words, we try to be what the other sex is looking for. What the other sex is looking for often feels like one of life's great mysteries, but it's really not so mysterious at all. Men and women want many of the same things in a partner. Kindness and generosity are near the top of everyone's list. And it doesn't hurt to be sexy, fun, and smart. But as I discuss in Chapter 4, it's not enough to be smart or sexy. It's critical to be smarter or sexier than the people around you, or you're still going to be the last one chosen. All our attributes are relative. That doesn't mean that you need to be tops in all domains, but it does mean that you need to stand out in those areas where you have the best prospects. In my own case, my towering 5'6" stature, combined with a 9-inch vertical leap, meant that my prospects were poor in basketball, so I never put much effort into the game. But my prospects were better in tennis, and I put in a fair bit of time on the court in a failed effort at self-improvement. It is important to keep in mind that I was never pursuing excellence on the court to get the girl, although the high school letter jacket and all that it entailed might have crossed my mind. I believed that I played tennis because I loved the game. Ultimately, though, it doesn't really matter what we think our motivation is. What matters are the consequences of our actions. If being a great tennis player is attractive to others, then my love of the game would have evolved because it enhanced my reproductive success. Similarly, the drive to be better than those around us often emerges in a desire for mastery. Mastery is important because our unique skill set differentiates us from others and makes us desirable as a mate. But the pursuit of mastery can be costly, as the underlying concern with relative status can easily put us on a hedonic treadmill, with each accomplishment quickly fading as we strive to keep up with, by which I mean surpass, the Joneses. Like our ancestor Craig, once we beat the Joneses, we set our sights on the Smiths. As a consequence, markers of success, such as wealth, have only a trivial effect on happiness, unless we have more than those around us, suggesting that it is status and not money that we are really after. Two sets of findings illustrate this point nicely. With regard to status, research on monkeys demonstrates that when they rise to the top of the status hierarchy, there is an increase in the dopamine, evolution's pleasure drug, sensitivity in their brains. As a result of this increased dopamine sensitivity, monkeys at the top of the heap no longer enjoy cocaine, a drug that hijacks the dopamine system. When offered cocaine versus salt water, these top monkeys show no preference between them. In contrast, monkeys at the bottom of the status hierarchy have low dopamine sensitivity and become avid coke users. Data such as these confirm the common wisdom that high status makes us happy and low status makes us sad. With regard to money, once people get out of poverty, the relationship between wealth and happiness is not as strong as you might think. Much more important, if all of society rises in wealth at the same time, increases in wealth beyond poverty provide no increase in happiness. Zippo. These data suggest that my home cinema, granite countertops, and convertible don't actually make me any happier unless I have them and you don't. In other words, I want these things only to put myself above others. Moreover, whether I know it or not, the reason I want to rise to the top of the heap is because that gives me a better chance of getting the partner I really want. The TV, countertops, and car are just trivialities. But because I don't know this, I spend my time coveting them, working to acquire them, and eventually becoming the disinterested owner of them. I'm not saying we have a strong desire to stand out, because we don't. We very much want to fit in, but we want to fit in at the top of our group, not the bottom. Unfortunately, getting off this hedonic treadmill is no easy matter. Millions of years of sexual selection have etched status concerns into the deepest levels of our psyche, so turning them off or even ignoring them is impossible for most of us. But awareness of the problem probably helps, particularly since it can allow us to focus our attention on other aspects of our lives that have the potential to provide more lasting happiness. Awareness can also help us be better parents or friends. We may be unaware of our own underlying status strivings when we lunch with the boss or try to improve our tennis game, but we are gifted with the ability to see through others. When we see our friends and family worrying about how they stack up against everyone else, we can be a bit more sympathetic to their insecurities, rather than asking why they care so much about what other people are getting and doing. Ignoring our ingrained status concerns may be impossible, but one solution is to spend money on activities rather than material goods. Buy things to do rather than to have. If you're like me, this possibility will strike you as counterintuitive, mostly because expensive experiences seem so self-indulgent. I remember feeling pangs of guilt in graduate school when I decided to spend my savings on a ski vacation, despite the fact that my only couch had been rescued from the side of the road. Even as I left for the airport, I asked myself if furniture might have been a wiser and longer-lasting purchase than a trip to Aspen. But it turns out that I had it exactly backward. The ski trip was a longer-lasting purchase than the couch. My ski trip from 1987 still makes me happy when I think about it today. My friends and I still talk about what a great time we had, and my wife would have long since tossed out the Naugahyde sectional I was considering in place of that trip. Research by Leif Van Boven and Thomas Gilovich of Cornell shows that I'm not alone in this regard. When people move from buying necessities to buying luxuries, their experiential purchases make them a lot happier than their material ones. This relationship holds even when the same object is bought for material reasons. I want to own a fancy car versus experiential reasons. I love to drive my new Jag down winding country roads. The next time you have money burning a hole in your pocket, keep in mind that experiences are a better hedonic investment than material purchases. The things we own lose their allure as soon as we reset our status goals. But the things we do become a part of us. Positive experiences give us the stories we tell friends and family, our most important memories, and continue to provide satisfaction long after the experience has ended. Happiness and survival. Survival goals are basic to all living beings, and many of our emotional responses evolved due to their survival value. We enjoy eating fat, sugar, and salt because they were rare in our ancestral environment, but critical for survival. We feel anxious and afraid when we walk through the woods at night because our reliance on our eyes over our ears and nose means that we're far more likely to be prey than predator once darkness falls. We are hypersensitive to the possibility that our friends or neighbors might reject us because expulsion from our group was an existential threat to our ancestors. We gain comfort and security from home and hearth because they provided our ancestors protection from the elements and predators. All these preferences have been around far longer than we've been Homo sapiens. However, despite their importance, survival goals are often trumped by reproduction goals. The most fundamental example of this trade-off can be seen in the aging process itself. We grow old and die largely because we spend precious biological resources on our efforts to attract, retain, and reproduce with mates rather than on tissue maintenance and repair. If we passed on our genetic material through longevity rather than reproduction, evolution would have ensured that we spent enough resources on tissue maintenance to enable us to live for centuries rather than years. In principle, such an outcome is possible, as longevity enables longer periods of reproduction and hence more offspring, but the prevalence of predators and parasites made any strategy based on longevity an unlikely prospect. Because our ancestors rarely had the opportunity to die of old age, efforts spent on living longer were largely wasted, and thus biological resources were better spent on more immediate mating goals. For this reason, a trait that helps us reproduce when we're young will typically have a selective advantage, even if it kills us when we're old. Such an effect can be seen in the epsilon-4 allele of the APOE gene, which is associated with an increased likelihood of developing Alzheimer's late in life. Ironically, this allele is also associated with better cognitive functioning early in life. As a consequence of the benefits it brings when we're young, this killer gene is widespread in the population. Evolution's tendency to sacrifice survival in service of reproduction means that we have numerous self-destructive tendencies that might be considered the psychological equivalent of the epsilon-4 allele of the APOE gene. Perhaps the most famous example of a psychological epsilon-4 allele can be found in male risk-taking and conflict. Often referred to as testosterone poisoning or just male stupidity, the biggest demographic risk factor in most industrialized societies is the combination of being young and male. Once men hit puberty, they are much more likely than women to die in conflicts with one another, car crashes, and pretty much every other type of accident. What many people don't realize is that male stupidity is actually an adaptation to female choosiness, as male risk-taking and conflict-seeking are a product of sexual selection. This may seem counterintuitive, as women are often the first to point out that they're not attracted by male stupidity, so let me explain what I mean. You can trace your male ancestry through your Y chromosome, or your father's Y chromosome if you're female. You can also trace your female ancestry via your mitochondrial DNA, which is inherited only from your mother and traces your female line. If you were to conduct these analyses in a large enough sample, you'd find that there were many more females than males in your ancestry. At first glance, this imbalance seems impossible, as it takes two to tango. But, of course, some men have lots of partners and father many children, other men not so much. Men are far more likely than women to have a very large number of children, and also far more likely to get left out of the mating game altogether. Risk-taking provides an opportunity to shift from being a monk to a Casanova, so men have evolved a tendency to take risks if those risks might pay off in reproductive opportunities. Because men have greater variability in their reproductive success, i.e., many men bear no children and some men bear a large number, they're more inclined to take risks than women. In contrast, risk-taking is imprudent for women, as they are highly likely to have a similar number of offspring whether they play it safe or take outlandish risks. Male stupidity is further enhanced by the fact that risk-taking itself is an honest signal of male quality. Thinking back to Chapter 4, you'll recall that this means that risk-taking communicates reliable information about how robust and skilled a person is. If you succeed at the risk, then you're skilled. If you fail but survive, then you're robust. If you fail and don't survive, well, that's indicative too. For this reason, women can use male risk-taking as a sign of quality, suggesting that men are likely to evolve a tendency to take risks when they have the opportunity to attract a woman. This idea had been widely demonstrated in the animal kingdom, but my PhD student Richard Rone and I were keen to see if we could find any evidence for it in humans. When testing a new idea, we typically begin as inexpensively as possible. So in our initial lab studies, we asked men to pump up cyber balloons on a computer. Every pump earned them money, but every pump also increased the risk that the balloon would pop and they would lose everything. Consistent with predictions, we found that men pumped the e-balloons larger after seeing pictures of attractive women. Chances are you're thinking the same thing we were. That's a perfectly good start, but it's not very impressive evidence of risk-taking. For our next experiment, we bought ourselves some shock balls on eBay. This delightful game involves an electrified ball that randomly lights up and simultaneously shocks whoever is holding it. We decided to use the shock balls to create a game similar to the one we used with the cyber balloons. Men would get paid for every second they held the ball, but if they held it for too long, they would lose all their money and get shocked as well. We thought that men might hold the shock ball longer if they were exposed to attractive women. Sure enough, that effect emerged as well, but we remained underwhelmed with the magnitude of the risk-taking involved in this task. Shock balls don't really put a premium on skill or robustness. The problem we faced is that it's not easy to study serious risk-taking in the lab, as it's unethical to put people in a situation in which they might genuinely get hurt. We struggled with this problem for a while before Richard came up with a great idea. Why not study skateboarders? They are taking some pretty serious risks already, and all we have to do is show up with an attractive woman and see if that makes a difference. So, we hired a beautiful research assistant and headed off to skateboard parks. In the first stage of the experiment, a male researcher approached a skateboarder and asked if he could film him making 10 attempts at a trick that he was working on, but hadn't yet mastered. In the second stage of the experiment, the same skateboarder was either approached by the male experimenter or by the attractive female we had hired, who asked to film the same 10 tricks. After the skateboarders completed their second round of tricks, we took a saliva sample to measure their testosterone. Just as we expected, testosterone went up in the presence of the female experimenter, and the higher the testosterone levels, the more risks the skateboarders took. As a consequence of their greater risk-taking, they crashed more often, but they successfully landed more tricks as well. Both outcomes serve a purpose as far as the skateboarders are concerned. Successful landings display skill, and crash landings show robustness. Sure enough, our participants shrugged off bleeding elbows and knees and also declined our ethically mandated offer of helmets and knee pads at the onset of the experiment. What can we infer about happiness from this conflict between survival and reproduction? The first lesson is that risk-taking and other foolish things that young men do are not pathologies, signs of their disconnection from the modern world, or other labels often provided by social commentators. Rather, They are evolved strategies that made perfect sense for our ancestors and probably continue to make reproductive sense today. The second lesson is that trying to prevent our sons, brothers, or friends from taking unnecessary risks is a bit like pissing into the wind. Removing